All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information or to volunteer, visit LibriVox.org. From the North American Review, July 5th, 1907, chapters from my autobiography, Chapter 20, by Mark Twain. Notes on Innocent Abroad, dictated in Florence, Italy, April 1904. I will begin with a note upon the dedication. I wrote the book in the months of March and April 1868 in San Francisco. It was published in August 1869. 3 years afterward, Mr. Goodman of Virginia City, Nevada, on whose newspaper I had served 10 years before, came east, and we were walking down Broadway one day when he said, "How did you come to steal Oliver Wendell Holmes' dedication and put it in your book?" I made a careless and inconsequential answer, for I supposed he was joking, but he assured me that he was in earnest. He said, "I'm not discussing the question of whether you stole it or didn't, for that is a question that can be settled in the first bookstore we come to. I am only asking you how you came to steal it, for that is where my curiosity is focalized." I couldn't accommodate him with this information, as I hadn't it in stock. I could have made oath that I had not stolen anything, therefore my vanity was not hurt, nor my spirit troubled. At bottom, I suppose that he had mistaken another book for mine, and was now getting himself into an untenable place, and preparing sorrow for himself, and triumph for me. We entered a bookstore, and he asked for The Innocents Abroad, and for the dainty little blue and gold edition of Dr. Oliver Wendell Holmes' poems. He opened the books, exposed their dedications, and said, "Read them. It is plain that the author of the second one stole the first one, isn't it?" I was very much ashamed and unspeakably astonished. We continued our walk, but I was not able to throw any gleam of light upon that original question of his. I could not remember ever having seen Dr. Holmes' dedication. I knew the poems, but the dedication was new to me. I did not get hold of the key to that secret until months afterward. Then it came in a curious way, and yet it was a natural way, for the natural way provided by nature and the construction of the human mind for the discovery of a forgotten event is to employ another forgotten event for its resurrection. I received a letter from the Reverend Dr. Rising, who had been rector of the Episcopal Church in Virginia City in my time, in which letter Dr. Rising made reference to certain things which had happened to us in the Sandwich Islands 6 years before. Among things he made casual mention of the Honolulu Hotel's poverty in the matter of literature. At first I did not see the bearing of the remark. It called nothing to my mind. But presently it did, with a flash. There was but one book in Mr. Kerr. I had had a fortnight's chance to get well acquainted with its contents, for I had ridden around the big island, Hawaii, on horseback, and had brought back so many saddle boils that if there had been a duty on them, it would have bankrupted me to pay it. They kept me in my room unclosed and in persistent pain for 2 weeks, with no company but cigars and the little volume of poems. Of course, I read them almost constantly. I read them from beginning to end, then read them backwards, then began in the middle and read them both ways, then read them wrong end first and upside down. In a word, I read the book to rags and was infinitely grateful to the hand that wrote it. Here we have an exhibition of what repetition can do when persisted in daily and hourly over a considerable stretch of time, where one is merely reading for entertainment without thought or intention of preserving in the memory that which is read. It is a process which in the course of years dries all the juice out of the familiar verse of Scripture, leaving nothing but a sapless husk behind. In that case, you at least know the origin of the husk, but in the case in point, I apparently preserved the husk, but presently forgot whence it came. It lay lost in some dim corner of my memory a year or two, then came forward when I needed a dedication, and was promptly mistaken by me as a child of my own happy fancy. I was new, I was ignorant. The mysteries of the human mind were a sealed book to me as yet, and I stupidly looked upon myself as a tough and unforgivable criminal. I wrote to Dr. Holmes and told him the whole disgraceful affair, implored him in impassioned language to believe that I had never intended to commit this crime, and was unaware that I had committed it until I was confronted with the awful evidence. I have lost his answer. I could better have afforded to lose an uncle. Of these I had a surplus, many of them of no real value to me. But that letter was beyond price, beyond uncledom, and unsparable. In it, Dr. Holmes laughed the kindest and healingest laugh over the whole matter, and at considerable length and in happy phrase assured me that there was no crime in unconscious plagiarism, that I committed it every day, that he committed it every day, that every man alive on earth who writes or speaks commits it every day, and not merely once or twice, but every time he opens his mouth, that all our phrasings are spiritualized shadows, cast multitudinously from our readings, that no happy phrase of ours is ever quite original with us. There is nothing of our own in it except some slight change born of our temperament, character, environment, teachings, and associations. That this slight change differentiates it from another man's manner of saying it, stamps it with our special style, and makes it our own for the time being, all the rest of it being old, moldy, In the 30-odd years which have come and gone since then, I have satisfied myself that what Dr. Holmes said was true. I wish to make a note upon the preface of The Innocents. In the last paragraph of that brief preface, I speak of the proprietors of the Daily Alta California having waived their rights in certain letters which I wrote for that journal while absent on the Quaker City trip. I was young then, I am white-headed now, but the insult of that word rankles yet now that I am reading that paragraph for the first time in many years, reading it for the first time since it was written, perhaps. There were rights, it is true, such rights as the strong are able to acquire over the weak and the absent. Early in 66, George Barnes invited me to resign my reportership on his paper, the San Francisco Morning Call, and for some months thereafter I was without money or work. Then I had a pleasant turn of fortune. The proprietors of the Sacramento Union, a great and influential daily journal, sent me to the Sandwich Islands to write four letters a month at $20 apiece. I was there 4 or 5 months and returned to find myself about the best known honest man on the Pacific coast. Thomas McGuire, proprietor of several theaters, said that now was the time to make my fortune, strike while the iron was hot, break into the lecture field. I did it. I announced a lecture on the Sandwich Islands, closing the advertisement with the remark, "Admission $1. Doors open at 7:30, the trouble begins at 8. A true prophecy. The trouble certainly did begin at 8 when I found myself in front of the only audience I had ever faced, for the fright which pervaded me from head to foot was paralyzing. It lasted 2 minutes and was as bitter as death. The memory of it is indestructible, but it had its compensations, for it made me immune from timidity before audiences for all time to come. I lectured in all the principal Californian towns and in Nevada, then lectured once or twice more in San Francisco, then retired from the field, rich for me, and laid out a plan to sail westward from San Francisco and go around the world. The proprietors of the Alta engaged me to write an account of the trip for that paper. 50 letters of a column and a half each, which would be about 2,000 words per letter, and the pay to be $20 per letter. I went east to St. Louis to say goodbye to my mother, and then I was bitten by the prospectus of Captain Duncan of the Quaker City excursion, and I ended by joining it. During the trip, I wrote and sent the 50 letters. 6 of them miscarried, and I wrote 6 new ones to complete my contract. Then I put together a lecture on the trip and delivered it in San Francisco at great and satisfactory pecuniary profit. Then I branched out into the country and was aghast at the result. I had been entirely forgotten. I never had people enough in my houses to sit as a jury of inquest on my question. I inquired into this curious condition of things and found that the thrifty owners of that prodigiously rich Alta newspaper had copyrighted all those poor little $20 letters and had threatened with prosecution any journal which should venture to copy a paragraph from them. And there I was. I had contracted to furnish a large book concerning the excursion to the American Publishing Company of Hartford, and I supposed I should need all those letters to fill it out with. I was in an uncomfortable situation, that is, if the proprietors of this stealthily acquired copyright should refuse to let me use the letters. That is just what they did. Mr. Mack something, I have forgotten the rest of his name, said his firm were going to make a book out of the letters in order to get back the $1,000 which they had paid for them. I said that if they had acted fairly and honorably and had allowed the country press to use the letters or portions of them, my lecture skirmish on the coast would have paid me $10,000, whereas the Alta had lost me that amount. Then he offered a compromise. He would publish the book and allow me 10% royalty on it. The compromise did not appeal to me, and I said so. I was now quite unknown outside of San Francisco. The book's sale would be confined to that city, and my royalty would not pay me enough to board me 3 months, whereas my Eastern contract, if carried out, could be profitable to me, for I had a sort of reputation on the Atlantic seaboard acquired through the publication of 6 excursion letters in the New York Tribune and 1 or 2 in the Herald. In the end, Mr. Mack agreed to suppress his book on certain conditions. In my preface, I must thank the Alta for waiving its rights and granting me permission. I objected to the thanks. I could not, with any large degree of sincerity, thank the Alta for bankrupting my lecture raid. After considerable debate, my point was conceded, and the thanks left out. Noah Brooks was the editor of the Alta at the time, a man of sterling character and equipped with a right heart, also a good historian where facts were not essential. In biographical sketches of me written many years afterward, 1902, he was quite eloquent in praises of the generosity of the Alta people in giving to me, without compensation, a book which, as history had afterwards shown, was worth a fortune. After all the fuss, I did not levy heavily upon the Alta letters. I found that they were newspaper matter, not book matter. They had been written here and there and yonder, as opportunity had given me a chance working moment or two during our feverish flight around about Europe or in the furnace heat of my stateroom on board the Quaker City. Therefore, they were loosely constructed and needed to have some of the wind and water squeezed out of them. I knew several of them, 10 or 12 perhaps. I wrote the rest of The Innocents Abroad in 60 days, and I could have added a fortnight's labor with the pen and gotten along with letters altogether. I was very young in those days, exceedingly young, marvelously young, younger than I am now, younger than I shall ever be again by hundreds of years. I worked every night from 11 or 12 until broad day in the morning, and as I did 200,000 words in the 60 days, the average was more than 3,000 words a day. Nothing for Sir Walter Scott, nothing for Louis Stevenson, nothing for plenty of other people, but quite handsome for me. In 1897, when we were living in Tedworth Square, London, and I was writing the book called Following the Equator, my average was 1,800 words a day. Here in Florence, 1904, my average seems to be 1,400 words per sitting of 4 or 5 hours. With the pen, I mean. This autobiography is dictated, not written. I was deducing from the above that I have been slowing down steadily in these 36 years, but I perceive that my statistics have a defect. 3,000 words in the spring of 1868, when I was working 7 or 8 or 9 hours at a sitting, has little or no advantage over the sitting of today, covering half the time and producing half the output. Figures often beguile me, particularly when I have the arranging of them myself, in which case the remark attributed to Disraeli would often apply with just this sitting force. There are three kinds of lies: lies, damn lies, and statistics. Dictated January 23, 1907. The proverb says that Providence protects children and idiots. This is really true. I know it because I have tested it. It did not protect George through the most of his campaign, but it saved him in his last inning, and the veracity of the proverb stood confirmed. I have several times been saved by this mysterious interposition when I was manifestly in extreme peril. It has been common all my life for smart people to perceive in me an easy prey for selfish designs, and I have walked without suspicion into the trap set for me, yet have often come out unscathed against all the likelihoods. More than 40 years ago, in San Francisco, the office staff adjourned upon conclusion of its work at 2 o'clock in the morning to a great bowling establishment where there were 12 alleys. I was invited, rather perfunctorily, and as a matter of etiquette, by which I mean that I was invited politely but not urgently. But when I diffidently declined with thanks and explained that I knew nothing about the game, those lively young fellows became at once eager and anxious and urgent to have my society. This flattered me, for I perceived no trap, and I innocently and gratefully accepted their invitation. I was given an alley all to myself. The boys explained the game to me, and they also explained to me that there would be an hour's play, and that the player who scored the fewest 10 strikes in the hour would This disturbed me very seriously since it promised me bankruptcy, and I was sorry that this detail had been overlooked in the beginning. But my pride would not allow me to back out now, so I stayed in and did what I could to look satisfied and glad I had come. It is not likely that I looked as contented as I wanted to, but the others looked glad enough to make up for it, for they were quite unable to hide their evil joy. They showed me how to stand and how to stoop and how to aim the ball and how to let it fly, and then the game began. The results were astonishing. In my ignorance, I delivered the balls in apparently every way except the right one. But no matter, during half an hour, I never started a ball down the alley that didn't score a 10-strike. Every time, at the other end, the others lost their grip early and their joy along with it. Now and then, one of them got a 10-strike, but the occurrence was so rare that it made no show alongside of my giant score. The boys surrendered at the end of the half hour and put on their coats and gathered around me and, in courteous but sufficiently definite language, expressed their opinion of an experienced, worn, and seasoned expert who would stoop to lying and deception in order to rob kind and well-meaning friends who had put their trust in him under the delusion that he was an honest and honorable person. I was not able to convince them that I had not lied, for now my character was gone, and they refused to attach any value to anything I said. The proprietor of the place stood by for a while, saying nothing. Then he came to my defense. He said, "It looks like a mystery, gentlemen, but it isn't a mystery after it's explained. That is a grooved alley. You've only to start the ball down in any way you please, and the groove will do the rest. It will slam the ball against the northeast curve of the headpin every time, and nothing can save the 10 from going down." It was true. The boys made the experiment, and they found that there was no art that could send a ball down that alley and fail to score a 10-strike with it. When I had told those boys that I knew nothing about that game, I was speaking only the truth. But it was ever thus all through my life. Whenever I have diverged from custom and principle and uttered a truth, the rule has been that the hearer hadn't strength of mind enough to believe it. A quarter of a century ago, I arrived in London to lecture a few weeks under the management of George Dolby, who had conducted the Dickens readings in America 5 or 6 years before. He took me to the Albemarle and fed me, and in the course of the dinner he enlarged a good deal, and with great satisfaction, upon his reputation as a player of 15-ball pool. And when he learned by my testimony that I had never seen the game played and knew nothing of the art of pocketing balls, he enlarged more and more and still more and kept on enlarging until I recognized that I was either in the presence of the very father of 15-ball end of the dinner, Dolby was eager to introduce me to the game and show me what he could do. We adjourned to the billiard room and he framed the balls in the flat pyramid and told me to fire at the apex ball and then go on and do what I could toward pocketing the 15, after which he would take the cue and show me what a past master of the game could do with those balls. I did as required. I began with the diffidence proper to my ignorant estate, and when I had finished my inning, all the balls were in the pockets, and Dolby was burying me under a volcanic eruption of acid sarcasms. So I was a liar in Dolby's belief. He thought he had been sold, and at a cheap rate, but he divided his sarcasms quite fairly and quite equally between the two of us. He was full of ironical admiration of his childishness and innocence in letting a wandering and characterless and scandalous American load him up with deceptions of so transparent a character that they ought not to have deceived the house cat. On the other hand, he was remorselessly severe upon me for beguiling him by studied and discreditable artifice into bragging and boasting about his poor game in the presence of a professional expert disguised in lies and frauds who could empty more balls in billiard pockets in an hour than he could empty into a basket in a day. In the matter of 15-ball pool, I never got Dolby's confidence fully back, though I got it in other ways and kept it until his death. I have played that game a number of times since, but that first time was the only time in my life that I have ever pocketed all the 15 in a single inning. My unsuspicious nature has made it necessary for Providence to save me from traps a number of times. 30 years ago, a couple of Elmira bankers invited me to play the game of Quaker with them. I had never heard of the game before, and said that if it required intellect, I should not be able to entertain them. But they said it was merely a game of chance and required no mentality, so I agreed to make a trial of it. They appointed 4 p.m. for the sacrifice. As the place, they chose a ground floor room with a large window in it. Then they went treacherously around and advertised the cell, which they were going to play upon me. I arrived on time, and we began the game, with a large and eager free list to superintend it. These superintendents were outside with their noses pressed against the window pane. The bankers described the game to me. So far as I recollect, the pattern of it was this. They had a pile of Mexican dollars on the table. 12 of them were of even date. 50 of them were of odd dates. The bankers were to separate a coin from the pile and hide it under a hand, and I must guess odd or even. If I guessed correctly, the coin would be mine. If incorrectly, I'd lose a dollar. The first guess I made was even, and They fed me another one, and I guessed even again and took the money. I guessed even the fourth time and took the money. It seemed to me that even was a good guess, and I might as well stay by it, which I did. I guessed even 12 times and took the $12. I was doing as they secretly desired. Their experience of human nature had convinced them that any human being as innocent as my face proclaimed me to be would repeat his first guess if it won, and would go on repeating it if it should continue to win. It was their belief that an innocent would be almost sure at the beginning to guess even and not odd, and that if an innocent should guess even 12 times in succession and win every time, he would go on guessing even to the end. So it was their purpose to let me win those 12 even dates, and then advance the odd dates one by one until I should lose $50 and furnish the superintendent something to laugh about for a week to come. But it did not come out in that way, for by the time I had won the 12th dollar and last even date, I withdrew from the game because it was so one-sided that it was monotonous and did not entertain me. There was a burst of laughter from the superintendents at the window when I came out of the place, but I did not know what they were laughing at, nor whom they were laughing at, and it was a matter of no interest to me anyway. Through that incident, I acquired an enviable reputation.